Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now are two key members of our team, our contributing editor, Chris Cavas, joining us from the Bethesda Bureau, and our very own producer, Chris Cervello, who's joining us from the Annapolis Bureau of the Defense and Aerospace Report. He is a retired commander and former public affairs officer. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago. Good to be here.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Chris Cavas, you joined me for the press call with Navy acquisition executive Hondo Gertz. Hondo deserves a lot of credit, and it's to constantly communicate with reporters throughout the coronavirus pandemic. He's somebody who had a good record of reaching out to reporters on a steady state basis anywhere, and credit goes to him and his public affairs officer, Captain Danny Hernandez. At the end of the day, it's not often that a senior government official apologizes for having missed a couple of weeks in talking to reporters. But it was an important call because it was his first in the wake of the Bonhomme-Richard fire. Obviously, we as a team have tried to cover that closely. A number of investigations are ongoing. Chris, start us off in what Hondo had to say new about where we are on the fire, and also the spate of fires that we've seen across the Navy. I think anybody who's familiar with the Navy and has been aboard ships knows that shipyard fires and shipboard fires are not extraordinary events, and they're normally put out very, very quickly and obviously don't, you know, burn a ship to the ground pier side. Talk to us a little bit about how the Navy is fighting this problem. Because obviously Vice Admiral Galinas, the new commander of the Naval Sea Systems Command, did put a stop work order on NASSCO's, the National Steel and Shipbuilding Company shipyard in Norfolk after a small incident, a melted vacuum cleaner in its yard in Norfolk while working aboard Kearsarge. But what were some of the messages? What were some of the key takeaways from the call with Hondo?
Well, actually now, Secretary Gertz put out a memo on July 24th for the shipbuilding and ship maintenance enterprise, essentially cautioning everybody that, you know, for on fire safety. Had no specifics about any particular incident, had no specific recommendations or any changes or anything like that. It's all just remain vigilant and be careful. There has been to date no specific recommendation or caution or anything coming out of this Bonhomme-Richard incident. And I asked the secretary about that. You know, why is there, you know, there's been no quick response reaction. Clearly this was something that had multiple elements that went wrong. Not one single thing. There were many things that contributed to the, at the moment, apparent loss or potential loss of this very large and very expensive ship.
As we've discussed, and, right, and you've noted, it was a cascading series of errors, like every important accident or incident.
Right. It's never one thing, but there's clearly a progression of bad decisions made as decision points came and went. And it's interesting that this 2 weeks later, we've got nothing from the Navy anywhere about this happened or that happened. You know, we can't talk about that. We're waiting for the report. There's a lot of things you don't need to wait for months and months for a report to come out before you can tell us some things that went wrong. And it is now becoming conspicuously interesting that nobody is saying anything about that. You mentioned Vice Admiral Galinas at Naval Sea Systems Command. I asked Secretary Gertz, you know, why haven't, you know, you could appear with the secretary to talk about fire safety. And, this is all about shipyards and things happening in shipyards, ships under construction and ships under maintenance. And he just said, you know, we haven't done that yet. It is curious. We've heard nothing from Vice Admiral Galinas. All shipyards fall under his purview, and he reports to Secretary Gertz. The fleet hasn't said anything. The CNO Gilday put a memo out, internal memo that was widely released or widely leaked or something, but that didn't really say anything beyond what he'd already said in his one press conference on the matter. So the Navy is really hushing up about this. The problem does continue. There was a fire on board the aircraft carrier John F. Kennedy under construction at Newport News Shipbuilding. And Newport News on its own shut down all hot work, you know, welding and anything involving flame on the ship for several days right away. I mean, they didn't, that was the company's initiative. The Navy didn't tell them, but then they kept that on for that stop work on for several days to do a pretty thorough review. You know, it is the nature of things when you're doing welding everywhere and widespread hot work like that. There's always the danger of fire. Complacency is something to always guard against. And even the most experienced people can forget, you know, and that has happened. But so, you know, so it does come with the territory. You can't get rid of hot work and build steel ships.
All of us are talking to friends of ours on the waterfront across industry and the Navy to sort of understand a little bit better the condition of the ship. Friends of mine who have been aboard have said, it's as bad, if not worse, than you can imagine in terms of the damage. Obviously, any ship can be repaired. The question is how much money you want to spend in order to do that. Did Hondo give us any additional insight? Nope. And have you gleaned any additional insight? And Cervello, if you can pitch in as well, what do we know about the condition of that ship, status of the investigation, what have you?
I mean, you know, so far the only public discussion about that has come from the CNO himself, who had a press conference a week ago in San Diego. And then he reiterated most of that in his internal memo, but didn't provide much else. So, you know, the ship is where the fire was. The ship is very, very burned out. Great damage throughout the hangar deck. The flight deck is severely damaged. The superstructure is burned out. Much of it is even collapsed. You would really have to gut a lot of the top sides of that ship right now if you were going to rebuild it. It's questionable how much you could actually save. So, you know, I mean, there's been no, obviously they haven't declared anything right now, but there'll be a cost benefit analysis to come out about this ship. Is, you know, it will cost this much to do it. Do we want to do that? Is that an investment worth making? You know, you go back to the submarine Miami fire in 2012. That was a very, very bad fire in the forward part of the submarine, but the submarine could have been repaired. It also would have cost, the estimate was $450 million on that submarine. Right. And for $450 million, they were going to get about three, maybe four patrols out of it. And then the reactor would run out of fuel. So it really wasn't worth that much money for that few patrols. Again, this is a ship that is already, even without any damage, was slated to decommission last I could find out was 2037 was her projected commitment.
She's already 23 years old, so.
Yeah, right. So she's, so even now, if you rebuilt the ship, it would take 6 years right now, the way things are, before you rebuilt it and recommissioned it and trained up again and were ready to deploy again. So that's, you know, so by that point, you've got maybe 10 years left in the life of the ship. And how many deployments are you going to get out of that? Three, maybe four. So again, for whatever hundreds of millions, half a billion, a billion, who knows, dollars, is that a worthwhile investment? That's going to be a tough call. They'll be criticized no matter what they do. And there's also the possibility that, you know, maybe you do something else with the ship. Maybe you don't rebuild it as an amphibious assault ship. Maybe supposedly, you know, the hull seems to be intact. The machinery plant seems to be intact. Maybe you do something else. Maybe you have some kind of expeditionary base ship, multi-mission, you know, disaster relief type ship. There are different things you could do. There's also the question in the industrial base, who would do this work? There's nobody on the West Coast that has the facilities to do this kind of work on a ship of that size. So Ingalls Shipbuilding and Huntington Ingalls Shipbuilding in Pascagoula, Mississippi, which built the ship and builds all these ships, is a logical choice, but they also have plenty of work, and this is not the kind of job that fits into their workflow.
Right.
So it would have a major impact on their new construction. There, it may be that some other facility that isn't doing work could bid on it. For example, Philly Ship in Philadelphia has the space for it. This is a much different job they've ever done before, but that wouldn't, you know, who knows? That's pure speculation, but it's just, it's not just Ingalls, but it is a limited set of potential contractors. So I mean it's that is so up in the, it's completely up in the air now. And if they lost the ship, if they just scrap it, well, that's a pretty unique situation. There's some other things to compare it with. One is the the Russians have one aircraft carrier, the Admiral Kuznetsov, which had a major fire that was up for a serious rebuilding. Very fundamental rebuilding in Murmansk, and they've had a fire, and they've had actually a series of calamities, and the fire is pretty bad. And right now they're claiming they're going to rebuild the ship. That's another one of these, you know, good idea, bad idea. I mean, either decision is probably not very good. The French just had a major fire on a submarine,
in a
refueling overhaul at Toulon. I always loved that. I've actually been in that dry dock on another submarine of the same class, the smallest nuclear submarines in service in the world. And the dry dock they do this in dates from the 1800s, late 1700s, and they redo nuclear submarines in it.
That's
in any case, this is a problem that afflicts all navies from different degrees, and sometimes it gets way out of hand. This is right up there in terms of being a major calamity. There's nothing minor about what happened to Bonhomme Richard. It's not supposed to happen, and it's still interesting that no one seems terribly upset about this. It's more like the Navy's tone is more like this is a, you know, it's an unfortunate thing that happened, and our young sailors performed really well while all this is going on. It's more like they got hit by a tornado. Well, and this is too bad, but we're all, you know, taking action. But this should never have happened. This is man-made.
And I want to bring Cervello into the conversation because we talked about this last week. There was an expectation when we and a number of other folks were calling for a wider review. Folks were saying, hey, you know, CNO is there. You know, there's a need to have a wider review. And then in the week since, we've not heard anything about a wider review. Cervello, give us your sense on where we stand right now, where the investigations are, and where we are on that sort of more comprehensive review that the more people I've talked to, and I think all of us have talked to, acknowledge that there's a need in order to do that.
So my sense in talking to both folks that are still in uniform and those that are out of uniform but are still pretty well connected, the Navy leadership has made the decision to focus on the accountability and safety elements of the investigation process. So that is to say that, you know, broader culture, broader Navy problems, as you outlined in your notebook and as we've talked about a number of times, probably won't happen until after that comprehensive accountability. The why did the fire start? Why did it take so long to put out? You know, are there bigger firefighting or bigger material conditions or bigger issues with yards? All that stuff is going to go first. As we talked about, I think that's a missed opportunity. I think that the Navy certainly does have the talent and the focus to be able to chew bubblegum and walk. That is to do, you know, multiple investigations at the same time. What I worry about is that they spend months doing the accountability part of the investigation and then, you know, sort of forget about the larger issues. But we'll have to see. One other comment that I would make, I do think to this idea that Navy has been very quiet on things. My sense, again, from talking to people is that that's intentional, that it, as they have looked back at some recent incidents, there's a belief that maybe they've over-communicated, particularly with the Brett Crozier incident there with the Theodore Roosevelt, that there were too many updates, there were too many bits and pieces of information that came out, and all it did was keep the Navy and the bad news in the press and front of mind for the American public. And so this is an approach to, hey, we don't have anything to say. We're going to focus on the investigation, and therefore there's no point in putting out little things, along the way. I think you can argue about whether that's the right approach or not, but my sense is that in this case, it's an intended course rather than they're just keeping their mouth shut.
I certainly hope that there is both, and I think all of us do, right? That there's, it's not about the punishment, it's about the lessons learned and obviously where we go. The concern is that it end there and it not get to a deeper appraisal, given that at the source of some of these have been sort of a string of, as Chris was saying, a cascading string of sort of bad decision-making, whether that was aboard USS McCain, whether that was aboard USS Fitzgerald, whether that was aboard Bonhomme Richard and the events surrounding the fires, or any one of a number of other incidents that has people wondering whether or not there are broader cultural and leadership dynamics that may be in play. Chris, do you want to add anything to that? Because I think if the CNO wanted to do something, there are a number of courses he could take on it. Find a highly respected retired flag officer, as in the case of Vice Admiral Belisle. Maybe you don't need something as in-depth as what Admiral Belisle did, which was an extraordinary work. Chris, you covered that extraordinarily well when we worked together. And maybe do something that's sharper in focus and more limited. There are fleet surveys you can do. The CNO can send out his own trusted advisors to go out there into the force and do some digging, right? I mean, there are a number of ways of doing it. Chris, what's your sense?
No, I think those are all great ideas. And we don't see any of that happening. I don't know where this is going. The message really is, the message of silence, as Chris Cervella was just talking about, I think is dead on accurate. And that's exactly what they don't need to do. If you were really concerned about this, if it was really important, you should really be talking about it. And if you're just going to be quiet about it, you're hoping we're not going to notice and it'll just go away. I don't know. There's a great big burned out hulk on the San Diego waterfront right now. That's, pretty obvious, and I don't see anything going away. So, just hiding from the problem is probably not a very good strategy.
I think, just to add to this, right, I think that the consensus was that there should have been sort of take advantage of the gravity of the situation to deliver that message of like, this is just sort of unacceptable. And the silence right. Just feeds into the, that's all right. You know what, this can go under the rug as well. Let's just be quiet. She was an old ship anyway. The shipyard wire transformer.
I want Ernie King to come back.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because Harlan Ullman, for those who know Harlan, I think it was in Cervello, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it ran in Proceedings, and talked yes. about, hey, you need an SOB like an Ernie King to sort of, you need to channel your Ernie King, which I think was his message to the CNO, obviously. Mike Gilday is a very different leader and very thoughtful and very competent in his own right. And he's not exactly the reputation, obviously, that Ernie King had. But is that what you're kind of talking about?
I think it's great. That's exactly what was needed. That was needed the day after the fire started. I mean, it was clear that this fire was getting worse and worse and worse. And if you let the fire in, but okay, maybe not the day after the fire started. By the end of that week, when they came out and had a press conference, somebody should have been really mad and should have acted like they were really mad. This is, and it's just not there. I mean, is anybody upset about this?
We are.
They are upset. I know that.
But they're not conveying that.
Well, right. And I think that they're, we talked about the Crozier incident. For all of the right or wrong that was associated, I think my sense is that that's what Tom Moodley tried to do when he flew across the world to go to TR, and he heard very selfish, what he believed were very selfish, woe is me messages from the crew of TR, whether justified right. or not. And he tried to kick them in the ass as a way of motivating them. And not only did that not resonate with the crew and, sort of the age demographics that we have and how people like to receive information, it didn't resonate with the media, and it didn't resonate with other influencers that called for his head. So I get it. I mean, I would love for somebody to be mad and for somebody to, you know, jerk a knot in somebody, but I just don't think that I think that part of the Navy's history is gone forever.
No guts. They have no guts. The fact that one guy came up and did something very badly does not mean that you shouldn't do it again. You know, the guy in front of you swung wildly and struck out. That doesn't mean you come up again and don't swing. It just means that, you know, okay, that was remarkably poorly done. No question about that. But just to say, well, great, I'm not going to do that. Your job is to be a leader. Your job is to set the tone. Your job is to make things happen.
Well, I think the other approach has been, you look to what we talked about it last week, but what Admiral Brad Cooper has done, where it's like, okay, I want to show my sailors that this is on my mind and that you know, we need to work on this stuff. So I'll go down in the trenches on the deck plates, whatever your favorite analogy is, and I'll train with you. I think a case could be made for either holding their hand through this or kicking them in the butt. It is seemed that generationally the kicking in the butt is not going to work.
Would the Marines have that
attitude?
I think that you can do both, and you can still be supportive and still have, for example, the SURF4, the Naval Surface Forces Commander, or your designated Fleet Forces Commander, whoever your designated tough guy is, to deliver a little bit of wood, because at the end of the day, it's still a first order military organization. And at the end of the day, it's not just about, you know, getting a trophy for showing up. It's about getting the job done. And when something doesn't happen, it has to be a bracing shot to the system. Otherwise, you know, you could lose a ship in battle, and there's no sort of like, well, people aren't, you know what I mean? That's, you got to be tough about this at the end of the day, right? To Chris's point, right? I mean, the Marines don't candy coat that part of it. And I don't think that, you know, it can be, you know, I've got my rack, I've got hot food, you know, it's, you know, I got it good, and I don't like it when people yell at me and get mad at me. I mean, at the end of the day, sometimes you need a kick in the butt to help you reset your counter. Let's shift gears, talk about hospital ships a little bit. Not one to ever allow an opportunity. I knew it was going to make Chris laugh. Not one to lose any opportunity to try to get money out of the budget system. Senator Shelby is proposing, unsurprisingly, that new hospital ships be made, four of them be made instead of the two steam-powered and very, in a sense, cumbersome ships we have that were utterly pointless in it was as pointless in Los Angeles as it was in New York City, ultimately. And I think we recognize that it was a very good, or maybe very not good, PR stunt. And there are folks who've been questioning the value of hospital ships, or certainly questioning the approach to hospital ships we've had, which are two very, very big ships of their design. Kavos, bring us up to speed on what Senator Shelby is proposing and why it is either a good idea or a bad idea, because it seems somewhat more dead on arrival than alive, which some people in the Navy were worried, and some people in DOD are worried that in the wake of this pandemic, the department's going to be forced to spend a lot of money on something that is not likely to be as high of a priority or maybe be as big of a danger in the future as it may have been in this instance.
I don't know that I share the generally negative view that you have about the use of the hospital ships in the pandemic.
That's not my assessment. I'm just saying that seems to be a consensus assessment. I'm very happy to entertain being wrong about it, but
I'm not so sure I agree with that assessment. So, but just to what's going on now. So we have this, this is a GOP Republican proposal out of the Senate for the HEALS Act, which right now is Republicans' idea in the Senate. Whether any of this comes to fruition or not, who knows? As everything on the Hill, everything these days, it's all political. Senator Shelby represents Alabama. There's a shipyard in Mobile, Alabama, Austell, USA, is a very good shipyard that is in does not have a good outlook right now, because the ships they build, the all aluminum multi-hull ships that they build, littoral combat ships and expeditionary fast transports, that those programs are coming to an end. So there's concern about how to keep this enterprise going. Among the issues here is you could have a medical version of the expeditionary transports, EPFs in Navy lingo. And these are not full-size hospital ships by any means. So there, people are saying these four hospital ships. They're not. They're small. They would have very limited facilities. They would, in essence, be more or less glorified ambulances, fast medical transports. They do have some. That they have a lot of car capability, but they'll never be anything more than a clinic compared to a hospital. So part of this is that's a provision for AUSTIL. They've also included another EPF, a straight EPF in that program. It's actually five ships there. Presumably they would be all for AUSTIL. It's not stated in there, but they're the ones who build these things. I think it probably clearly is an effort to keep AUSTIL in business and give them work while they figure out how to retool their yard for steel construction and stay in business for the long term. There's a lot of support on the Hill in general for the idea of a hospital ship. There's no military requirement at the moment. There's no plan that includes these ships. That doesn't mean that they can't be done. Congress can certainly say, we want you to build these, and whether you want them or not. Which they've done many, many times before. We'll just wait and see what happens. If you want a real hospital ship, this is sort of the irony, is that you're talking about new construction. So two alternatives to hospital ships. One is that, or new hospitals, four new hospital ships. One is there's this National Security Multi-Mission Vessel, which is a contract that's just been awarded by the Maritime Administration for six training ships for the Maritime Academies. These are very large, nice, multi-mission ships, very capable, very adaptable to a medical mission if you wanted to do that. Every system in those ships will be familiar to operators, which is a key element. The two existing hospital ships are steam powered, and that's a problem because most people, you can't find very many people who are licensed to operate those plants. But so that's an idea if you wanted to do new construction. They're 524 feet long, plenty of size, good space, everything, if that's what you want to build a new one. The alternative is that if you really want something, right now there's a fire sale on cruise ships. The cruise industry has collapsed over the pandemic. And just in the last couple of weeks, a number of large, very nice, perfectly good cruise ships have driven themselves up on the beach at Aliaga, Turkey, to be scrapped because it's just the market's collapsed. It's not going to come back anytime fast. People are getting rid of these things. They're not just laying them up. They're getting rid of them. This is very adaptable to the hospital ship role. Tons of internal volume, rip out all these cabins. You have lots of hotel services. The power plant is more than capable of supplying any needs you want. They have plumbing, they have power, they have volume, and they're available for a bargain. So if you really want a hospital ship, they're out there right now. Buy one of these hulls. You get them real cheap. Conversion will not kill you.
One of the other things you need, right? They have massive water production capability as well, which right. You need.
All the hotel services is how they exactly. refer it. Yep.
Cervello, yep. Your view on this, and then I've got one quick question which I want to put to Cavus before we part.
You know, McKinsey brought this up yesterday. McKinsey England of the American Enterprise Institute and the Roundtable brought this up. And, you know, I mean, it was kind of, there were differing views on the effectiveness of this. I think the idea beyond the value tactically of the hospital ship is DOD's approach to, hey, let's just keep money flowing, even add projects as a way of keeping the prime solvent so that they can keep the subsolvent and that people can work. And then at the end, we get things out of it that whether we need it for a pandemic or whether we need it for larger great power competition, you know, the money that we're spending doesn't go completely to waste. That's juxtaposed to this idea that It's all or nothing, that it's either all this next phase of relief. And I don't want to get out of my lane here because clearly this is a round table expert discussion, but it, you know, largely the debate has been posed as, hey, we need to take care of Americans and American businesses that are suffering, you know, sort of the little guy, if you will, or we need to make sure that we're taking care of the big guy and make sure that business, large businesses, is, and particularly defense, is taken care of. I think there's something in the middle. I think there's going to have to be something in the middle because both ends of the spectrum are suffering and are going to continue to suffer. So I think there's a lot more to this. I think we're going to hear more about the hospital ships and other things. I mean, it's almost tantamount to the discussions that come about after the budget is released and you get a look at the services unfunded list, you know. So I think we're going to see more of these kind of unfunded pet project things bubble to the surface as the Congress figures out how it's going to take care of both the little guy and the big guy.
Very quickly, since I have a noted reporter and a public affairs officer on, what did you make of that little incident that we saw this week about reporters being referred to as adversaries and lumped along with terrorists? It was for an internal training module. Obviously, bad language, but very quickly, what was your sense on it? Cervello, why don't you take it from the standpoint of a public affairs officer, and then Cavas, want to get your take as well.
Completely indefensible. There's no way to defend the fact that that word, that descriptor, was used in the training. It's unnecessary to the lessons that the training is trying to put forward, which is simply sort of the loose lips sink ships and be careful about what type of information you put out. So that's no different whether you're talking to a member of the media or you're talking to your mom or you're in a restaurant and somebody around you who you don't know is listening to you. I give Secretary Esper a lot of credit for telling his staff to change that training. There's no room for that, especially now, given the climate and the tenor of the relationship with the professional press. And at the end of the day, words matter. And you cannot call what I believe are patriots in members of the media. You cannot call them adversaries. And so I'm glad they made the change.
Cavas?
Well, you know, that's the opinion of a professional from Commander Cervello here. This is you know, the kind of thing that is under assault along with so many other things in the government these days. This is not, those are not terms, you know, to call the media adversaries or lump them into that is not what a professional would do. It's just not. And it is appalling. I'm happy that this is being called out. I'm happy that certainly the House, the Democrats in the House are now putting this into legislation. The sad thing is that there are more people than we'd like to admit maybe within the government and within the Pentagon who do feel this way. And it really is a shame. It's just statement of where we are.
I'm going to give credit to Dr. Esper on this one. I think he's tried to maintain the right tone. I think he reversed some things that Secretary Mattis had done, which had clamped down too far. And he always has made the case, use your best judgment, and you know what to communicate, and you know what not to communicate. And I think he has faced and taken hard questions from reporters and deserves a lot of credit for that. As somebody who has an exceptionally tough job to be the buffer and ultimately the civilian executor of his boss's policies. Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope both of you have a great weekend.
All right, thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago. Have a good weekend.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.